So now I'm very happy to introduce Thomas. He's from the University of Madrid, Barcelona.
It's okay.
But there are people in the room from Madrid University, so I've switched them already. We will have a super interesting talk by now. It's actually on adaptive epigenomics regarding to humans and in comparison to our closest relative, the great ape. So, Thomas, it's...
Okay. Thank you, Daniela, and thank you to all the organizers to bring me here. It's been a very, very interesting topic. I do really like integrative workshops where people from different disciplines are essentially brought together to discuss certain things. So I do work, I will not be talking about that, with a little bit with brain, and that's also clearly one of the topics that allow us to talk between different disciplines and clearly epigenetics, and now seeing how psychologists are in fact so interested to epigenetics, it's clearly one of these occasions. So I hope this talk will also contribute to the essentially the understanding between different disciplines. So essentially I wanted to start with just very briefly who we are, because at the end what I will be presenting, I feel sometimes very miserable, because in fact, I mean, it's them who actually do most of what you will be seeing today, right? So my group is essentially these people over here. We work in this fantastic place, which I know it's very close to the sea, which is very convenient for the students. Not so much for the PIs, but it's okay. My group is essentially, and I think this is an important point, we were discussing that yesterday, but I have this, in my view, a very unique combination of computational power. So I will say that pretty much six out of these eight guys are purely computational, but then there is experimental wet lab in my lab. And that's, I think, in my view, to study the kind of molecular process we want to study, it's still something that needs. In my view, we have gone through a trajectory where, you know, 5 years ago it looks like that wet labs were, or most of the genomic labs were kind of abandoning wet labs and really into computational. I think that now more and more we are, of course, getting back to wet lab in order to first control our own data and specifically to validate results. And I'll be talking briefly about that. So human evolution. So I will say, and again, sorry if I'm reiterating some of the statements I was mentioning to you yesterday, but the kind of question we want to answer, which again we will not resolve, but at least we want to contribute, is I want to understand what makes us human, right? Human, it's a very unique species in many, many ways, and not just because of the population size, because of the many behavior and anatomical features we have. And the truth is that if you revise the literature, there are very, very, very few human-derived traits that have been able to then be mapped to a particular locus and to a particular mutation that has happened just in the human lineage, okay? So in my lab, we have been interested by this particular topic, so trying to understand the molecular basis of human uniqueness, and to do that, the tool that we are using is comparative genomics. So there are many tools to study human-derived features, and the way I approach this clearly challenge is by comparing humans to extinct humans as well, but specifically with great apes that, as you know, it's our closest relative, okay? So traditionally in the lab, just because of my trajectory, which I clearly come from, I'm a zoologist by training, and then I moved to population genomics, and I will say that this very first part is what is still today the major part of my research group, which we are still trying to first characterize genomic variation in great apes and humans in order to put the human variation in an evolutionary perspective. And to do that, we do typically whole genome sequence. This is just essentially what it's been produced today. Some of the work that we've been doing has been done, of course, in collaborations. For instance, Alex is here, and Alex is one of our collaborations working with Orangutan Genomics. But all of this essentially has created a background, which is to me just the first piece that we need in order to understand what makes us human, which is first you need, of course, a very good understanding what is the level of genome variation. And genome variation, it goes much beyond SNP variation. So if we think about global genomic variation, there are certain traits. I mean, doing chromosomal karyotyping, that's easy. Doing SNP genotyping, that's easy. But then in the middle, there are a lot of genomic features that are not that simple to understand, like short tandem repeats, copy number variation, inversions, which is still the dark side of genomics. So all of that, it's part of the area that essentially we are working here. So it was logical then that after we are starting to understand at which extent there is population variation, the next step was at which extent that variation then translates into phenotypes. And of course, I understand as a phenotype humans, as an organism, but we cannot be yet that ambitious. So sometimes we restrict ourselves to define phenotypes, for instance, gene profiling or other molecular bases. And it's because of that we have also a couple of papers on transcriptomics, always, when possible, working with the same individuals. And that's something that in my lab, I mean, we've put a lot of effort to try to singularize projects and objective, but always, when possible, working with the same material. And that is obvious, maybe for most of you, but at the end, you realize that you need to integrate different layers of complexity in order sometimes to resolve some of the questions you have, right? So for some of these, we have a very complete transcriptomic profiles that we've been able to link particularly to microsatellites and tandem repeat variation. And recently, we start a very new line to me, I will tell you a bit later, which is epigenetic profiles on these samples, right? And finally, the third line of research is about candidate evolution, but I will not talk about that because we have Bridget here, who is much expert than me, but you will clearly understand why dogs and canids in general, it's a fantastic system in order to correlate genotypes and phenotypes. And since one of the things in my lab is copy number variation and trying to correlate copy number variation with traits, in that regard, humans and primates, it's not the system that you would like to work with. That's the reason we are working with canids, okay? So let me start with Irene. Irene is this girl over here. She comes from the Complutense, by the way. And I always like to start, every time I'm talking about DNA methylation, with her picture, because she did something which I value a lot. And if I may, this is just to encourage, especially master students, and maybe for PhD students as postdocs is too late, but for master students is not too late. But she did something that to me was unique, and that's the reason I took her right away. So she essentially came to me after one of my talks about population genomics and all of that. And so I was at that point only studying genomic variation, and essentially she came to me with a bunch of papers all highlighted, you know, in fosforito, I don't know the name in English, you know, the yellow stuff and so on. And she said to me, okay, I think there is a deficit in the field to study epigenetic evolution between humans and primates. There are not enough material, not enough papers. Would you be interested to tutor me for that PhD? I was just blown away, because typically, I don't know in Germany, but I tell you that in Spain, typically, the students come to you and they expect you to tell you what they have to do. So then suddenly seeing someone that has such a clear vision, what she wanted to do, and she was asking me for help to move forward, I was like, okay, we will do it together. And I'm really grateful, because I mean, after we start, and you will see her production was great. She's now in Cambridge with Wolf Wright, studying epigenetic profiles on development. And you know, now I have a new line of research, which is bringing grants to the group. And it was because of her. So I think that the very least that I can do is to acknowledge her in this talk, okay? So essentially, we start with DNA methylation, okay? Why? Well, because remember that we wanted to start slowly because we were learning together, and at that time, you know, there were several constraints. When you start with non-human primates, One constraint is the samples. I'll be talking about that later. And the other, it was budget, obviously. So in that regard, we wanted to start slowly. And the main questions first we wanted to address, it's related to this slide. So this is something that has been in the air for many part of this workshop. I think that Thomas mentioned that yesterday and other people, is that when we think about epigenetic profiles, clearly there are two kind of profiles that you can think of. One is the environment or sequence-independent epigenetic profiles, and the other is the sequence-dependent profile. Clearly, my view as an evolutionary biologist, and my view in order to study the differences at the species level between humans and non-human primates, I will be talking almost exclusively, for not to say exclusively, on sequence-dependent epigenetic profiles, okay? So I will not be talking on this kind of events, which is most of what we saw yesterday and what we have seen in the previous talk about the kind of adaptation that you get in epigenetics. So in that way, I want to make this distinction because it's important, right? So in that regard, the four papers or the four works that I'm going to present in the next minutes, two of them are published and two of them are totally unpublished. They fill within the, if you want to mention the new field of comparative epigenomics, specifically under the light of human evolution, right? And to me, the main questions that I was interested on, to start with, I know that's not the big question, and you, Thomas, made a very, very relevant question, which is, so far, we are dealing with correlations. And this is highly frustrating for everyone interested in causative events. But the field, or at least when we started our papers in 2011, the production or the literature was very minimal, so I really thought on again, trying to scale from very narrow scopes to the bigger questions, is we first should start answering small questions. And small questions, that doesn't mean they are not interesting, they were interesting to us and I think to the field, and it's, first of all, it's to define at which extent humans and the closest great apes do share or do not share epigenetic profiles. I mean, this is super simple, but at that time it was not yet solved, right? And finally, which is the relationship between the epigenetic markers that we will see, hopefully, at lineage-specific manner with the subjacent genomic variation. That simple, okay? So, again, I mean, I do not want, and I'm not saying that, of course, that we are alone. There are very awesome papers and very relevant information out there. The problem or the limitations is that if you look at these three papers, so most of them are about histone methylation, and the sample availability is critical to study human evolution, specifically when you are getting into primates. And if you revise the literature before 2011, you will realize that the main comparison was always human macaque, of course, because human, it's easy. I mean, there are ethical concerns and all of that, but it's easy to obtain. But then macaques, they are widely used for biomedical research. There are large colonies in lots of places. So getting samples for them, it's easy. What is not that simple is when you are going into the great apes. And there are two reasons for that. One is because you know that there are recent regulations that a lot of centers that used to do biomedical analysis with great apes are now closing because it's not allowed under standard circumstances to experiment with great apes. And the second is that even if you have access, typically chimpanzees kind of common, but then the rest of the great apes, it's really difficult to find them in the conditions that you would like to have them. So our idea was then to study, first of all, the dynamics of DNA methylation and genome evolution, but a very fine scale. And very fine scale essentially means now comparing humans, chimps, gorillas, orangutans, and macaques, okay? Having all, so if you have that, I maybe should have put, well, anyway, it will come in the next slide. But essentially, just having every time point of close living relative to human, comparing human to the rest of the great apes. Okay, so I had this slide because this is something that reminds me to tell you. So this is one of these slides that essentially is a message for me, not for you. The motivation to study what we do. So in 1975, so I'm talking a long time ago, there was a very influential paper by Mary Clare King and Rick Wilson. So Mary Clare King is a very extraordinary woman. She's in Seattle, so I had the pleasure to meet her there. And she's mostly known for her work in the BRCA1 and the mutations on breast cancer, right? But before that, when she did the PhD, she was the first to study amino acid differences between human and chimpanzees. And she has a science paper, two people, just Rick Witzel and her, analyzing the amino acid profile between human and chimpanzees, and the conclusion is awesome. I'm talking in 1975. Their conclusion is, or was, it still is, the two genomes are far too similar to explain the phenotypical differences that we see between humans and chimpanzees. Then, the differences and the basis of human uniqueness will be on the regulation of such repertoire. So, essentially, they were already telling us, and it's something that, I mean, in the last 40 years, we have been essentially replicating that, but by looking microsatellites, by looking mitochondrial, by looking full genome, by looking, and it's true. Let me just make a quote here, but it's also an important quote, especially for the psychologists that maybe you are not that exposed to our literature. Also, Thomas yesterday he had that tree where he was showing that between human and chimpanzees there is 1.2% divergence. That's not right. Okay, that's a figure that I don't know why, but it's in our collective brain for years. It's because of the 2005 paper and the 2009 paper that we collaborate and we did that calculation. And what was written in that paper is that under the most conservative alignments and the parts of the genome that we can recognize themselves, if we just count single nucleotide polymorphism, the minimum divergence between human and chimpanzees is 1.2%. And that was because at that time there was only one human genome assembled, one chimpanzee genome assembled, and recognizing the parts was not easy. More than 12% was left out of these alignments. And after that, a lot of people, including my group, has been re-evaluating this number. And now, when you include indels, insertions and deletions, you include copy number variation, you include rearrangements, you include the missing, we were talking about these pieces in the genome that are in humans and not in great apes, so clearly we are talking an order of magnitude bigger than the 1-2%. So the right number will be closer to 10% and not to 1%, okay? The problem, and sorry, I got distracted with that, but I think it's an important message. The problem is that no one can tell you yet the exact number. And the reason for that is because despite of our pretensions to having finished genomes, the genomes are not finished. The genomes are still working draft with plenty of the repeat not finished, many of the heterochromatic part not finished. So until we will have really finished genomes where every single nucleotide and our cells will be sequenced and assembled properly, we will not be able to do these comparisons right, okay? But this is just to again, drop this idea that although we are far too similar, it's not 1-2%, okay? It has to be, and it had to be, higher than that. So let me start with the first work that we did with Irene. So we start, again, small. So the whole idea was to take 32 samples, covering against human, chimps, bonobos, gorillas, and orangutans. It's blood-derived DNA. I'll be talking about that because that clearly creates problems, as you can imagine. And the idea was to essentially take the Infinium human methylation that yesterday you were introduced to this chip, and now it goes the critical point. So this chip was designed to hybridize human samples. And the probes that were synthesized to capture the DNA that is next to the CpG that you want to interrogate for biosulfite, essentially, it's based on human probes. So the very first thing that Irene did, and that was a lot of work, is first of all to assess the performance of that chip in non-human primate samples, okay? And I will skip some of the details, but essentially, at the end of the day, what we found out is that obviously, when there is a perfect match between human and the other species, the probes works perfectly, obviously. When there are less than two mismatches in the distal part of the CpG you want to interrogate, the hybridization also works properly. But then, when of course you have mismatches close to the CpG, then essentially the results were not that reliable. So at the end, for the rest of the presentation of this part, we were using essentially only perfect match probes, and when there was mismatches far from the CpG. The problem is that at the end, just we end up with almost one third of the initial 450K, and we were working only with 114,000 CpG sites that were equally working equally well in all the species. The very first thing that we noticed, and that was of course expected, but it's not until you see that you say, okay, this is working properly, is that when evaluating only the beta values for those probes that are 100% identical, totally conserved across all these 15 million years of evolution, and you do a phylogenetic tree just out of the beta values, you can recapitulate almost perfectly the phylogeny, the known phylogeny. So that will be essentially the humans in two populations. That will be the species of gorillas, the species of orangutans, and here bonobos and chimpanzees. Okay. So again, this is expected, or this is what I will have predicted, but it's just a good way to exemplify that even at the species level, of course, there are epigenetic profile that is characteristic of these species. Obviously, one of the things, even with this limited data set, one of the very first things we wanted to do is to characterize the derivative CpG sites, right? Specifically, when there were genes in that. And essentially, at the end, there was like more than 2,000 CpGs that were with a different profile in humans compared to the rest of the great apes, some of them in genes. What I thought it was interesting, although it's something that we have not been follow up, essentially, I have to tell you, because we don't have a clear connection why this happened, is essentially the whole promoter region of precisely BRCA1 looks like it's differently methylated in humans compared to the rest of the great apes. One of the concerns, very big concern we had, I'll go back to the previous slide, is that, remember, we are working with blood. And with individuals, sorry, I didn't say that. We tried, when possible, to match gender, so same amount of males and females per category, and also the age, although, you know, trying to match ages between human and orangutans, it's not that simple, but when possible, we try to match that as possible. But working with blood, and we work with blood because obviously it was the easiest thing to retrieve to us, that creates problem, and at which extent we are looking at the evolution of epigenetics in blood instead of the evolution of epigenetics at species level, right? The good news is that the 450K array is a very widely used chip, so there are plenty of data in other tissues for humans, not for great apes, right? But we were able to see that essentially those sites that after filtering, we end up showing that they had very strong differences between human and chimpanzee, do these results replicated in the other species, showing that at least the CpGs are not blood specific, but were a signature of species specific. Before someone asked, because this was a nightmare, but it's what it is, and we've been talking about that. Sometimes you have to deal with the nature of the design. Clearly, one of the biases that we could have had in this experiment was different cell composition in blood. So if there are different compositions in humans and chimps of neutrophils or whatever, that could influence the epigenetic characteristics. So what we did, it's also to sort the blood and to make 450 cases of these particular cell types and then look at the contributors at each particular cell type. And we found that there was pretty much 25-30% of variance just because of the cell composition. So when we jump from 2000 to 453, it's because we restrict ourselves to those changes that had more than 30% of variation between what it's seen in humans compared to the rest of the great apes to account at some extent for different composition in the cellularity. So the other thing that
Well,
I will have to rush. Maybe I will not get to Neanderthals, which is. So the other thing that we found, and we don't have a good explanation for that, and it's something that we are still exploring, although it's very difficult because at the end it's a correlation, is that what we found is that systematically and statistically significant, those sites, those genes that had more differences in epigenetic profiling at the promoter, which you know that it's inversely correlated with gene expression, those genes are also the ones that have been evolving faster at coding region. Okay, so there is a non-random association between having the promoter epigenetically distinct between species and then either the number of amino acids or the KAKI or the NDS or whatever you want to call it, which is a measure of how rapid is the turnover on amino acids. And this is something that, you know, we've been thinking about, and we have some hypotheses about at which extent it's the egg and the chicken, right? It's first it comes the epigenetic profiling, which modulates the regulation, and in order to buffer that in the body, there are some changes, or there are some changes in the coding sequence, and in order to control that in the damage in gene expression profile, there is gene promoter epigenetic controls. But it's something that clearly we are interested on. So let me just move, because that was the second work that we did with Irene, and it was the obvious step, right? So remember that the problem with 450K is that you are only evaluating like 100K CpG sites. The obvious next step was to move to bisulfite. So what we did in this regard is then to do whole genome bisulfite genome of two humans, two chimps, two gorillas, and two orangutans. The very first thing we notice, and again, this is more a quality check than a result, but I think it's interesting, is that when you do the correlation genome-wide, chimpanzee methylation between and human methylation, clearly there are two clusters, which is either methylated or not methylated, and you can see the Pearson the correlation essentially between all pairs. That will be human chimp, human gorilla, human orangutan, and so on and so forth, right? And you can see two things here. First, there is a certain correlation genome-wide, which is higher, as expected, in the promoters, because we know by the literature, but it's also part of our results, that between 80 and 90% of the promoters are conserved at epigenetic level. So this is pretty much what we are showing here. And also this thing here, which is, as it's been said during this workshop, one way that our genome has to prevent the dispersion of repeats is by methylating them. And we know that repeats have been evolving much faster than any other part of the genome. So it's not unexpected that we see less correlation in repeats than, for instance, in promoters. So the motivation for this bisulfite sequence, it's again that we had the genome sequence. Remember my first slide when I was talking, we do genome sequence and then now we do bisulfite, which means that for these guys we had already all the available genomic information. And then we can overlay the epigenetic information. The question that we wanted to answer, and we did that in two ways, which is the next two slides, is at which extent the genomic variation is coupled with the epigenetic innovations. Again, I will not advocate for a causative profile, but first of all, we wanted to evaluate if these two things go together. So essentially, what you're seeing in this slide is essentially sites where human had a specific window, 1 kb, where there is a specific CpG profiling in epigenetic that is specific to human compared to the rest of great apes. And what we did is then to calculate the nucleotide change also in a lineage-specific manner, so what happened in the human branch compared to what happened in the chimpanzee, what happened in gorilla, and what happened in orangutan. And at the end, and that was replicated for human-specific, chimp-specific, just that I'm showing the human-specific, but you can see that next to the DMR, there is an increase on the number of lineage-specific change, which is something that you don't see in the other species. When we will move to the chimpanzee-specific, you will see an increase of lineage-specific changes in the DMRs that are chimpanzee-specific. Again, that doesn't mean, because of course, these are CpGs that are conserved, so it's not the CpG that has changed through the course of evolution. But that means that in that area, there is some lineage-specific changes as well at genomic level. So the other analysis we did, we took advantage of something that in population genetics it's been well known for many years, which is incomplete lineage sorting. So incomplete lineage sorting is a phenomenon that happens in populations that fulfill two criteria. One, there is huge or a substantial amount of individuals in the ancestor of the three species, which is a surrogate to say there was ancestral variation. And then there are two speciations that happen in a very small time frame. And this is exactly what happens between human, chimpanzees, and gorilla. Okay? So if you remember that, the common ancestor of these two is pretty much 5 to 7, and the common ancestor to human, chimp, gorilla, it's, I don't know, 7 to 9 or 7 to 10. Okay? So this is really, really close. So when there is this big variation in the ancestor, for most of the genes will follow the phylogeny of the species, which means that if I now do the coalescence, which means that I go back in time trying to find the common ancestor of this gene and this gene, you go that they go to this coalescent point, but if now I want to go back in time to the gorilla mutation, so that essentially goes back right up there, right? So that will be that human and chimps are more connected, and then they are more connected to gorilla, as expected. But sometimes, and in fact in more than 1/3 of the human genome, that's not the case. And what we have is connections like this, where in this case the human mutation just goes back in time to this mutation here, which is connected to the gorilla, and then the chimpanzee mutation will be even further back in time. So in this case, human and gorilla will be more connected than not the connection to chimpanzee. Okay? This is a very well-studied demographic phenomena, and in human and chimpanzee it's been very well-studied. So we took advantage of that with the reasoning that if there are certain patterns of epigenetic profile that it's because of the subjacent genomic background, incomplete lineage sortings at genomic level, DNA sequences, and incomplete lineage sortings at epigenetic level should coincide, should be in the same regions of the genome. And what we did is partition the genome in situations like this, so human is closer to chimpanzee, then gorilla, and then orangutan. And then we replicate the correlation as expected. But when we start looking at portions of the genome where chimpanzee or gorilla are closer, then we start seeing changes in the pattern, or this is even better, right? Human and gorilla are more connected, and then we see that the correlation is higher than, of course, for human and gorilla compared to the rest of combinations. So another advantage of the bisulfite is that, again, there are plenty of human data sets around. And similarly to what we did in the past, because, again, this bisulfite data was created from blood samples again. And what we did here is just take our human-specific DMR, and what we saw is that, in fact, 65% of the whole blood human DNRs were still valid in the particular blood cells, but, and it can be only or still, 30% of all the human DNRs were still detectable in all tissues when we have now this very precise information compared to what we had before, right? So in general, and of course, this is what we are now working in other studies as the potential of species-specific derivative epigenetic profiles. And what do these regions contain? Well, again, another advantage of interdisciplinary or just participating in other consortiums is the ENCODE project, right? So the ENCODE project just generated tons of data about histone modifications. And what we show is that essentially all these human-specific DMRs have an excess of overlapping with two things. One, with transcription factors that have human-specific derived mutations. And second, with chipseq results based on histone modifications. So there is an enrichment of transcription factors and histone modification changes in these human DMRs. So I will skip this one. This one was essentially a recapitulation of, after these two papers, we wrote a review with Irene, essentially showing that at least in the work that we've been developing in the lab, that will be the main five scenarios where we see that human and chimpanzees have changed the epigenetic profile. And sometimes it's because of change in the CpG. There is quite a few, a substantial portion of MET-QTL, so QTLs for methylation. There is also, of course, transcription factors, mutations in specific transcription factors that just modulates the binding. And this is also one of the biggest now areas, which is at which extent retrotransposon movements have essentially brought CpGs ups and down just by modulating then the promoters of particular genes. So what's next? So this is now unpublished data, and I'm very excited about this project. So one of my frustrations of these previous two papers, and all the reviewers keep asking, and I think, of course, they were totally right, which is the typical comment we got from these two papers was, okay, you have shown us the epigenetic profile, at which extent these epigenetic differences then do have an impact on gene expression profile. And the problem is that I think a lot of groups are generating data for human evolutionary genomics, but And of course, it has to be that way, right? Each group just generate the data set that is of their interest. And then, when I was trying to answer such a simple question, what I found is that when there was a data set that had the epigenetic, they didn't have the RNA. When they had the RNA, they didn't have the genome, and they didn't have the epigenetics. So there was not a single data set that had everything together. So that's the reason last year I decided to start an ambitious project to characterize a panel of 10 cell lines, so two human cell lines, two chimpanzee, gorilla, orangutan, and macaque. This has been lymphoblastoid cell lines that have been immortalized in the lab, so in principle, they do not carry any of the aberrations that happens during the long pass transformation. And for all of these cell lines, we've been doing deep sequencing of the whole genome, complete bisulfate sequence. We've been doing transcriptome profiling, both with Illumina and PacBio to have the isoforms as well. Five chipsecs with different enhancers, promoters, and then ATAC-seq, which someone yesterday was asking me about ATAC-seq. ATAC-seq is a new method that was published in 2015. The idea of this method, and there are many, there are literally like six or seven papers trying to address the question, where is the chromatin open at a particular stage during the cell division? And essentially what ATAC-seq does is they make use of retrotransposons. So you know that retrotransposons, when they move, they insert in sites where the chromatin is open. So they just devise a protocol to make an hyperactive retrotransposon activity, and when the retrotransposon moves, it brings the Illumina adapters, it circularizes, and then you sequence the extremes, and then you know where the retrotransposon has been jumping, and then you can have a map or where the chromatin has been opening, right? So all of this has been generated for these 10 lines, tell cell lines, and we are now in the process of just starting to look at the data. I wanted to include this word here, the comparative genomics paradox, because it's very important. I think it's obvious to most of the audience, but if it's not, I think it's worth to just stop and make just a few words on that. So, I mean, leading a lab on comparative genomics, I know that comparative genomics is the way to go to study certain human particularities that are shared with other species. So, for instance, if I want to study recombination, mitosis, whatever that is really at the cellular level and it's shared with other species, then you go to Drosophila, C. elegans, mouse, macaque, or whatever, and you manipulate the organism with either knockouts, removing fragments of the genome, so you do whatever you want, and at the end you are trying to reproduce a phenotype that is shared with humans. However, how do we test human innovations? By definition, human innovations will be just in our genome. It will not be in any other species' genome. So typically, it's been the idea of getting bags of the genome and getting that into mouse and getting the mouse to vocalize or have test of behavior or socializing, this has been done. And don't get me wrong, to my knowledge, I think this is getting to a plateau and we are reaching an end because it's been known now for many years that just integrating a portion in the genome into another genomic background that doesn't reproduce what is all the epistasis and all the complexities of the human genome. So in that regard, I think the best that we can do today is to use cell lines. So that's the reason that I've been really investing quite a lot on this. And again, that will be the first step on an even more ambitious project to then, after this first characterization is created, my long-term plan is, of course, to create stem cells out of that and then convert them to hepatocytes, neurons and all of that, and then study along the way how all these changes happen during the transformation, with the advantage, of course, that now for the very first time we should be able to manipulate and introduce or remove mutation in these cell lines and just make a humanized chimpanzee lymphoblastoid or a chimpanzee and all of that. Before you tell me, I know there are many limitations and a single neuron will never be a brain. I'm aware of that. But if any of you have a better idea, please come to talk to me, because I think that this is really one of the deficits in the field of human evolution, which is how to make human innovations to know the functional consequences of human innovations. Okay, so how much time do I have? Or? 5 minutes, good. Oh, it's raining, lovely. I'll go quite, so if you allow me, I'll go quite fast on this part because it's essentially preliminary data. So essentially we are, as I was saying, just since we have all the genome for all these cell lines, we can estimate SNPs, indels, and shorten them, repeats, and copy numbers. We can, of course, start assessing the CpG profile, which we find something that was an unpleasant surprise. You can see that one of the orangutans have a very deviation of the standard epigenetic profiles. It's funny because this looks like a cancer cell line that we have been comparing to, so we really don't know what was with this orangutan, but this is what it is. I mean, we are not going to repeat everything. In terms of gene expression profile, we did 3 replicates, and all of them, of course, are very much congruent, and in a PCA they cluster as a species as they should. I will skip this one, and if you allow me, I will go. Maybe this is the most interesting slide. It doesn't show anything, but it just shows what we want to do. So essentially, here you have on the left RNA-seq, here you have the 5 ChIP-seq that we have, and for all of this you have the transition, the phylogenomic transition from macaque, orangutans, gorillas, chimpanzees, and humans. And you can see certain patterns. For instance, that will be something that is specifically upregulated in humans compared to the rest of the great apes. The interesting stuff is starting right now, which is how to match these things with all these active promoters, accessibility, and all of that. And we have now the data that, in principle, should allow us to start matching all this kind of informations and see something like this, right? This is now a summary of you have seen before, where you can see portions of the genome where, for instance, this is a conserved transcription active promoter in chimpanzees and gorillas, but in human has been reconverted to either enhancer or sometimes it has lost the function. Very briefly, because I know that and I will not hide that. I love Neanderthals. I've been involved in the different genome sequences of Neanderthals and Denisovans, and I think that all scientists, we all have this paper that when you read it, it's like, I mean, you are very happy because intellectually it's just awesome, but you hate the guy that has done that because that is the paper that you will have loved to have this idea, and to me, I'm. This is, anyway, I will skip that, I will go directly to the paper. This is the paper I'm talking about. So Liran Carmel, who is a researcher in Israel, had this amazing and beautiful idea, and it is still a revolution, that had this idea, and he realized about something that even the most experts on the field, like Svante and many other people, did not think about, which is that during the degradation of Neanderthal DNA, the cytosines that are methylated do degrade to different form than cytosines that are not methylated. So the whole idea is during the status of deamination, during the time that the bone has been buried, there are some cytosines that are methylated that are essentially changed to thymine, but essentially not all of them, because that's not something that happened in all the molecules. So you will have a variation of cis to tis here, where for unmethylated regions, all the cis will go to uracils, and then essentially during the amplification, that will be removed. Which essentially, at the end, that leave a different pattern, and just by looking at the sequences of the Neanderthal genome, you can differentiate regions of the genome that were methylated from regions of the genome that were not methylated. Okay, that paper was a blast, and they found even on top of that certain genes related to to collagen and cartilaginous development, which, you know, it's one of the big features between human and and modern humans and Neanderthals, that had the promoters differentially methylated. So what's the next step? And I'm very excited about this result. This is not published data. It's in bioarchive, by the way, if you want to read it. But essentially what Liran, me and other people, but this is essentially Liran's work. So he should take all the credit. So essentially he has been taking all the ancient DNA, Neanderthals and Denisovan, but also all the Mesolithic and Paleolithic and even some samples that are before present. And he has been creating these ancient epigenetic maps. We have compared that to human bone maps, because remember that, of course, the methylation patterns that we have from Neanderthal and Denisovan, it's bones, right? So this has to be compared to present-day human bones and also to chimpanzee bones. And just to make a long story short, this is the way that we reconstruct that. And the whole idea is, again, to separate what has happened here compared to essentially the separation of Neanderthals and Denisovans. I will skip that. They essentially, just for this project, they have developed a very interesting data set, if any of you is interesting. They have been making a very wide search on published data, but also generating data on their own, and finally to be able to link epigenetic profiles and tissue. So at the end, it's a web page that also works with the scripts if you want to download it. And essentially, instead of doing, you know, that we all do this go term enrichment, and you see, oh, there is an enrichment for immunity genes. Now you can not just do that. You can, introducing epigenetic data, it will essentially tell you if there is enrichment in which parts of the body these epigenetic profiles are most likely to be active. So to make a long story short, what we have found is that essentially almost 2% that are most highly derived in modern humans and ancient humans compared to Neanderthal and Denisovans are in the whole architecture of the Boyce box. And this is important. So one of the typical examples is the NFIX, which again it's been related to many deficiencies in the Boyce box formation. And essentially the whole idea is, and you know it's one of the big things in human derivative traits, which is at which extent language is something that belongs only to human. There is a huge debate whether Neanderthals could speak the way we do or not. Some people think they are not because of the architecture of the Boyce box. But this is my last slide, so I will leave it here. And I know it's provocative. And again, I'm not trying, so I remark for the video, not trying to make a causative cause that epigenetics is what modulates this specific trait. But clearly, this enrichment of genes that have a particular epigenetic feature only in humans and modern humans, that it's never seen in apes or Neanderthals, and seeing an enrichment on all these essentially genes related to the architecture of this particular part of the body, it's tempting to at least speculate that it did contribute to our evolution. So just to finish, some messages that we can skip, because I mean, I didn't change that, so it's in your slide, but I really would like to thank here, of course, Irene, who was again the one that started the whole thing, Raquel and David, who are now the guys that are leading the cell lines, the cell line project, Liran and David for allowing me to participate in this exciting project, and of course all the funding that supports the lab. Thank you.
Thomas, that was really an excellent talk. It was super nice how you really understandable introduced this very complex research you do. And I think you made very good points also on the challenges you have when comparing species. And also you gave very nice points on the future directions. So that was really amazing listening to you. Any questions? Yes.
So how do you think you can make this step beyond correlation? Remember the FOXP2 story where you're trying to get genetic mice to tweet more? That has anything to do with correlation. How would you do this?
Yeah, so it will be tough, but I think the best chance I had is CRISPR on these cell lines. So just to take candidates, for instance, I can tell you the very first thing I will do is take these mutations on the NFIC genes and all these genes, and then put it in a chimpanzee background and in a human background and study the transition into chondrocytes and see at which extent I do see any difference in the conformation, in the density, in any morphology that I can measure. I think this is the best chance we have to prove at a certain point that is that particular mutation and not anything, because the plan is just to change a single epigenetic profile or a particular lossy as narrow as possible and leaving the rest of the genome. And the plan is, of course, to take the human mutation into a chimpanzee background and the chimpanzee mutation into the human background, the ancestral and derivative. If I manage to convince myself first that then there is a consequences in the phenotype, a gene profiling, epigenetic profiling, or morphology of the cell lines, I think to the best of my intellectual capacities, that's the best that I think I can do in my lab to prove that a mutation is related to a phenotype.
Did you say what your cell types are in neurons?
No. They are today lymphoblastoids. So the very first point is to transform them to stem cells. And after that, the idea is to just specialize them in some of the different... I mean, clearly in my mind, I mean, neurons have to be there. I'm interested on hepatocytes because of some things that I have now, and I'm also maybe chondrocytes or so. There are particular cell types that I will be interested to then transform for specialization. And always the plan will be after they are stem cells, it's again to introduce or remove mutations and then have them develop and taking gene expression measures every certain time or things like that. Sorry.
As you know, there was a long list of traits that are supposed to be special to humans. Speech, imitation, hands, and chondrocytes are not only expressed in the voice box.
I agree. I was going to say I'm fully aware, but I think I'm not 100% fully aware of the problems I will face. But I've been thinking about that, and again, I think it's the best that I can do. But if you think it's a bad idea, just tell me. I think it's still the it's not perfect, but in my opinion, it's the right step into the functional characterization, because I can, I mean, clearly we will not manipulate neither humans nor great apes. I mean, that's totally, and it should be like this, of course. So we should work with cell lines with all the limitations that they have, which are many, eh? But I think it's the best chance we have. If you have other questions, I mean, or ideas, just talk to me, because I mean, we are right beginning on this particular part of the project. I think it's a good idea, but I'm happy to receive criticisms now and not in 3 years from now.
I'm not sure if that's a good idea, but if you look at the evolution, or if you look at the development also of children or human children, there's a point where they start to speak. And did you ever consider to measure modulations? I mean, that, I don't know if that's even ethical.
Yeah. To me, I mean, this is something that was also in the conversation yesterday. I think that everyone has to put their goals and objectives according to the capacities and the resources the lab has. And with my respects, but the human community is it's not my community. To me, it's very, very difficult to get human samples, because every time I've been trying to approach, it's a super competitive field. People is really jealous about the samples they have. I don't have the resources to start now what it takes to start getting the samples myself for the lab for the next 5 years. I simply don't have the resources. So I thought about that. But I mean, maybe it lasts for 1 minute or 2 minutes, because I realize it's not in my hands to gather that kind of data.
Also, Rick, for your big plan and the cell lines and the transcriptome patterns, I'm wondering a bit, what would it tell you? Because I work from scriptomics, and it's so plastic. So when you say, oh, there's no expression of a gene, is this also in cell lines?
Yeah. No, the plan, and this has been proven before. So we know there are certain switch on and switch off of certain genes that then are markers for certain cell, specific cell types at tissue level. So this, there are many papers that show that during the development from stem cells to the adult cell, there are certain genes that are activated and deactivated. So my plan will be, after I introduce or remove mutations, I would like to see, and we also have, of course, the background, what do we expect in these particular cell lines in human and chimpanzees. My idea, maybe naive, but it's the best that I can come up with, is after introducing the mutation, I would like to then correlate and see to which extent the gene profiling of these particular genes, we are able to resemble the other species after I introduce these changes, or it remains the identity of the particular species. Does that make sense?
It makes sense. My question was more, but I think you have a better database with all the gene data in the background. Just if you have your cells at 10 degrees in the lab, or 20 degrees, you'll have a different transcription profile. So when you standardize, it shouldn't be a problem, but how you know, oh, this gene is not expressed?
Yeah, no, but. I mean, of course, I'm talking about situations where I can have all these variables control and just focus on the genes. I mean, we've been doing that as well. And there are, of course, standardized lab ways to focus only on those genes that are markers for the cell-specific type. So that will be the goal of the phenotype of this transformation.
Do you know which ones you need? Because I always don't know for my studies.
Yeah. No, I mean, it depends on the cell type. So I know that for to create muscle cell lines, it's different than to create a neuron and to create, but there are the maps of these switches across the, to me the key point is the specialization, the cell type specialization during development. Yeah? So.
I'm wondering if you can distinguish between genetic and epigenetic transcription in the system, since most of the DMRs you described have been found in transcription factor binding sites, and you have shown that they also sequence variation of the circuit. And also the recent literature DNA methylation shows there's a lot of influence in transcription factors on DNA methylation itself. So do you find sequences which are homologous between the brain apes and humans but have differences in DNA methylation?
Yes. So yeah, I've been worrying about that a lot, and notice that I've not been talking about that because it's still unclear to me at which extent one thing determines the other. Meaning that we do see sites that I didn't talk about that, but there are sites that are 100% conserved at sequence level with no polymorphism in the many apes that we have sequenced, and of course many of the humans, and still they do show very strong epigenetic patterns that are markedly different between the two species, right?
Are sites associated with this regulation?
This is the part. So notice that my limitation as it is today is that this intellectual jump from I do see differences in epigenetic profiles to then the phenotype at any level, it's something that I do not control yet. I mean, I hope that with these cell lines, I should be able to tell you to which extent then this epigenetic profile just modulate the gene expression, even if there are no variation at the promoter or the transcription factor bindings. But it's something that, to be fair, I don't know yet.
So if there are more questions, we will have a coffee break now, so you're more than welcome, I think, to address more questions to Thomas.